Welcome to the Stokecast, where each week we bring you an inspiring athlete, adventurer, or entrepreneur and dig into their stories and strategies for balancing work, life, and adventure while having fun and making a difference. I'm Jonathan Ronzio.
And I'm Emily Holland. Thanks for joining us today.
Let's get to it. Welcome to the Stokecast, episode 2, actually our first official episode, post you learning a little bit about who me and Emily are. Today on the show, we've got Brody Levin, and we'll tell you a little bit about Brody in a second. Once we jump into his interview, I'll kind of list off his resume of feats. But I will say one thing that really, you know, prior to even chatting with Brody, I had known who he was for years and felt like the trajectory of our lives were somehow paralleled in a way, in the sense that just the way he approaches a multitude of adventure sports, and Brody kind of like is a self-professed adventurer, you know, not a professional this or professional that. I mean, probably mostly a skier, but he even says like skiing is what he likes the least of what he does.
So true. Yeah, I think with him, I've known about him for a while too. And I think the thing that resonated with me is that he's very like self-aware and understanding that like being pro doesn't mean you have to be the best, but maybe the best version of yourself, but also like, bringing something new to the table or like taking risks or doing something a little bit beyond, what is the clear path towards something, you know
right.
what I mean?
Yeah, what did like, you say earlier? You don't have to be pro to be professional, right?
Yes, I did say that.
Spot on, Emily.
So smart.
So yeah, that's what I love about Brody's story in the sense that he just owns the fact. He even says he's like, he's a professional adventure skier, but not the best skier.
Yeah.
And just is out there having the most fun, trying to just plan these expeditions and go for it. And you'll hear a little about how he got to where he is and, you know, how he initially approached brands and tried to get sponsors behind the crazy things that he was doing. And really how he went from a Midwest DJ to a professional adventurer.
Yeah, he has a really interesting background of like growing up in the Midwest and around no mountains to like, going to some of the biggest mountains in the world and skiing like the craziest lines and also like having a business around his name.
That's right.
So
super well-rounded guy, really fun to talk to. And I'm sure you're going to learn a lot from Brody's story. Hope you enjoy. So today on the show, we have Brody Levin. Brody is a professional adventure skier, storyteller, avalanche awareness educator, and environmental steward. You can find Brody climbing and skiing some of the world's wildest mountains, bikepacking around Iceland, Norway, or Pacific Northwest volcanoes, dangling off rock walls, or even rocking the suit and taking his adventure stories to the steps of Capitol Hill to advocate for climate change policy. Did we miss anything, or is that it?
No, that was awesome. Thanks for that.
All right, great. Well, thanks for taking the time to chat with us today. We're excited to dig into your stories.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, so Brody, we want to definitely talk about your mountain adventures and the rad stuff you're doing outside, and obviously your activism work that you're doing in DC. But first thing we want to get into is where this journey began for you. So where are your roots? Where did this all begin?
I like grew up in like a very adventurous place, like huge mountains, just surrounded by people climbing mountains. It's this little town in northeastern Ohio, outside of Cleveland.
Ohio on everybody's bucket list.
Yeah, totally. It's hard to miss if you love mountains, but I was fortunate enough to grow up there and super flat. I grew up like 5 minutes from a ski hill, but the ski hill is 210 vertical feet.
Is that Brandywine?
It's Brandywine's like little sister. I would get to go to Brandywine like twice a year for big ski vacations because that was like 45 minutes away.
Gotcha.
And I didn't grow up in a family of skiers, so if my parents wanted to take me somewhere like Brandywine, or if I got super lucky like Pennsylvania, they would have to just sit in the lodge while I skied like bell to bell, and so it wasn't, the most practical thing to do every day, but I could, they could drop me off at Alpine, go home. And then it's called Alpine Valley. And I would do this thing where I'd, cause like 12-year-old me skiing around, and I would ski, like I would be the last person on the hill. Like I remember multiple times the lifties would come out of their shacks, because it takes like literally between like 4 and 11 seconds to get down the runs. And the lifties would come out of their shack. It would be like pouring rain. It's like 10:30 at night, because I didn't know there was day skiing until I moved out of Ohio. I had only skied at night, like after school.
Oh, wow.
And so the lifties would like come out of their shack. It's like raining and nighttime, and I'm literally the only person at the hill, and they would be like, "Brody," and I'm like, "What?" They're like, "Go home so I can close this place up and go home." Cause and so I'd like go into the lodge and pick up the payphone and press 0 and call the operator and say, "I'd like to make a collect call." And the operator would say, "Cool, who?" And I'm like, give them my parents' phone number, and I'd call home, and you know, they'd say, "Please state your name at the beep." And I'd go, "It's Brody, come pick me up." And so my parents would get this collect call from, "It's Brody, come pick me up." And I wouldn't have to pay the, you know, 20 cents for the phone call that way. And they would just come, and I would just keep taking laps for, you know, 6 minutes until they got to the bottom. And you could just see the parking lot at the bottom. So I would see when the one car pulled in, and then I'd like ski up to the car, and I'd be like, "Guys, I learned this new trick." And they'd like, you know, watch me take one more lap, and I'd go up and I'd come back down. And so, yeah, I did that a lot, like every single day. I mean, I started only skiing one day a week. And then by the time I was like 14, I got a season's pass and I was skiing every day. It was awesome.
Yeah, so you were out there by yourself?
Yeah, pretty much on my own. I had like one ski buddy, because, you know, they didn't have like I was a park skier, right? Like I liked hitting jumps and rails and skiing backwards, except we didn't have a park. And so like I would like build these own jumps with my hands, and then that was like against the rules. And so I would like build the jumps with my hands until like the bad guys who were like, I don't know, they were ski patrol or somebody on that would just ride around on a snowmobile. They would like come find you, and they would like ride over your jump with their snowmobile, and you'd be like, "Oh man, I just spent like 15 minutes making that." And you know, they'd like be like, "Ah, you got to stop doing this, Brody." And I'm like, "Okay." And I like go do it somewhere else. And I'm not one to break rules, but that's like the one big rule I've broken in my life is constantly building jumps.
So it sounds like you were kind of always internally motivated by your own personal passions. Like at an age when everybody else is out there trying to do things socially to fit in, you had your own thing, and you were just out there doing it.
Yeah, my parents would always say like I was like beating my own drum, because it was just like, you know, I was a soccer player. That was like the real thing that I did. I like played soccer every day and blah, blah, blah. And like that was my sport. But I just had this, and like that was like a very normal, you know, kid thing to do. And in the way in which I did it, you know, I played in the traveling team and the whatever, the select team and for the high school and everything. But I just had this other thing that I always seemed to like more, which was skiing, which didn't fit. I mean, I would sit there and throw like temper tantrums and just cry with my parents when I was a little kid and be like, "Why did you raise me here? Like, this has ruined my life. You know, like, why can't I be one of these guys I'm reading about in the magazines that grew up in Aspen or New Hampshire, you know, somewhere crazy mountainous?" And it was so like defeating, because I'm like, I'm never going to make it, because something about me, I'm like, I want to be a professional skier. And I'm like, a 12-year-old in Ohio who sucks at skiing. I wasn't even the best at my little hill. Like, straight up, there were just, like, kids better than me. And I was like, but what is it about this that I like so much? And I just kept going.
Yeah, so what is it about skiing or about being in the mountains that keeps you pushing and keeps you going, keeps you motivated?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I'm sure you guys can relate to this. Like, it's evolved. You know, like, what I originally liked about it, which was literally the act of skiing, which you ask, you know, so many people what they love about skiing. It's like, oh, like the sound of this snow beneath my feet and like the wind through my hair. Like that's not it anymore for me. I'm sure that's what I liked in the beginning, and the adrenaline rush. I still love the adrenaline rush of like it's changed from park skiing to ski mountaineering, but right. I still love that rush of, you know, trying to do things safely and stay alive, but still to push my body and my mind. But it's also changed. Like it's morphed into, you know, skiing is my vehicle to see the world now, and it's my vehicle to meet people and try to do good, and it's also my career. So it's, you know, it's changed a lot over time.
Totally, man. I feel like I relate in a very similar way. I mean, I can think back to building snowboard jumps behind my middle school, and like when I threw my first 360.
Oh, and, heck yeah, man.
Yeah, and how, like, at the time, that was everything. And for snowboarding, that was it. But now snowboarding is more a means to experience the mountains.
Totally. And that I didn't know would be the case when I was in Ohio. You know, I didn't know I craved the experience in the mountains. I just liked the act of riding. But once I was able to get out, which I went to, like, a I saved all my pennies and went to, like, a ski academy for my last 2 years of high school. I moved to Vermont and went to the ski academy where I could ski 6 days a week for half the day.
Nice.
Awesome. We would, like, get tutored the other half of the day. And it was, you know, it was super expensive and it was really hard for me to go to because I was paying for it myself, my little, you know, my teenage self. And it was, but I was like, you know, if I want to see if I have a chance in skiing or if I just want to ever get out of Ohio, like, this might be my way to do it. So I like went to Vermont for 2 winters in a row and really fell in love with it and realized that A, I was definitely not the best, and B, like, it is something I truly enjoy doing.
Yeah. So it sounds like going from Ohio to then Vermont and eventually the mountains out west, you had to be willing to take some uncomfortable steps to kind of break past the norms for what an Ohio kid should or...
And that's kind of like pervasive in my life. Oh, sorry.
No problem. Yeah, let's get into it.
It's like pervasive. Like I shouldn't be making it. I shouldn't be the one loving it coming from Ohio. And the same thing now, like I shouldn't be a professional skier in some regards. You know, like I'm not the best skier out there. And people think professional athlete, you think someone who is the best, and I am not the best, but I figure out how to make a career doing what I love to do and not being the best, because it's not all about just being the best, especially these days, you know.
Right.
As far as being an asset to the brands and that I work with and those kind of things, and in relating to my fellow skiers, like, not, you know, never, most people aren't the best at their ski hill, and so I've been able to kind of latch on to that concept of the best is not always the most important. And in my case, that's really lucky, because I can't be, you know, like I'm just not the best. I'm a kid from Ohio who's skiing every day.
We're both just nodding our heads over here. Like, that's, yes, absolutely. I think so many people can relate to the fact that, like, you can succeed without having to become the best.
And there's, like, the aspirational people you look up to because they are the best, you know, like I'll go on photo shoots with some of my friends who are the best skiers in the world. And that is an amazing experience for me. And I look up to them the same anyone looks up to them. And that's really, really cool for me. And I'm like, those people deserve to be professional skiers. So what is it about me that makes me deserve it?
So we got the backstory of growing up in Ohio. We talked a little bit about going to Vermont to test out skiing out there. And then you end up going to college out west. So tell us a little bit about that decision and the journey out there.
I wasn't even going to go to college. I'd say a vast majority actually of professional skiers end up not going to college because it interferes with their ski careers. And for me, it was for a different reason. I had started this business in Ohio when I was 9 years old.
Oh, the
I started
DJ business.
This DJ business. Exactly. You did your homework. Yeah. You heard of DJ Extreme like in 1999, really? And so, yeah, I started this business and it was doing great, you know, not when I was 9, not when I was 11, but when I was 14, I hired an employee.
Wow.
And when I was, when I was 14, it was full time. When I was 15, I hired an employee. Like it was doing really well. And I was very entrepreneurial and I was really driven, and I was really driven by money and by showing people a good time. And it was like super Ohio of me. You know, like that was like the most Ohio thing you can do if you're a driven person. I'm like, man, how can I be different and like do what I want to do and like, and you know, succeed? And like starting a business was very practical to do.
All right, hold on.
Yeah.
Let's backtrack on, you started a business at 9 years old. Like let's talk about how, why?
Yeah.
And that like early entrepreneurial version of yourself, like let's talk about how some of those characteristics have translated into what you do today, the business of Brody, how you market yourself.
Sure. Yeah. Great question, man. It came from like the entrepreneurial part is just like me. I like, you know, I didn't need to have a job when I was 9 years old, and really like the business didn't start at 9. I took a $300 loan from my parents when I was 9.
Nice.
And I paid that back eventually by DJ. I think I had my first DJ job when I was 9 years old. I DJed like, you know, a friend's Halloween party and got a $50 gift certificate to the CD store for it.
Ooh, the CD and, store. Nice.
Yeah. And like, it was, I'm sure it wasn't a $50, probably a $15 gift certificate, like enough for, you know, one CD. And that was like the start of it for me. And I don't know why I was so driven to do something different. My family didn't have a lot of money, and I certainly didn't need to go out, be, you know, financially on my own when I was 14 or whatever, like I ended up doing, in many regards. But there was just something about it. And I think it kind of rooted, I had like this really intense love of hip hop when I was like young, like, you know, 8, 9, I just like loved like breakdancing and the Beastie Boys and the radio stations that played Ja Rule. And like, you know, I was just like, I loved rap music and I loved hip hop and I loved kind of that whole culture as much as you could be informed of it, you know, without the internet and with MTV, and that's about it. And I was just super into it. And I saw all those DJs like scratching, like on MTV Spring Break. And like, they were like scratching vinyl records, you know, like that sound. And I loved that. And I'm like, I want to get a turntable and some vinyl. I'll use my dad's old vinyl. And like, I want to make that scratching sound. And I took that $300 loan and I bought a turntable and a mixer.
Awesome.
And a needle. And I got one of my dad's old records and I put it on there and I didn't know how to make that sound. So I took the needle. This is in my parents' basement when I was nine years old. I took the needle and I just dragged it across like my dad's old Beatles record.
Oh, that's what I was going to ask, if your dad knew what record you were scratching.
And he didn't know how to do it either. You know, like I also got like my first skateboard when I was 8 years old or whatever. And like, he didn't, I'm like, which foot do I put in front? And he's like, I know there's like this thing skateboarding, but I don't know which foot you put in front. You know, it's like without the internet, without like movies, and just by virtue of being in Ohio and not being surrounded by like, I don't know, culture of any like diverse variety, you know, or like of any information like that. And so I'm just dragging this needle back and forth. I'm like, that's kind of the right sound, but I don't think that's quite it, you know. And so I eventually got a mail order catalog and I mail ordered a VHS tape that was like instructional of like how to, you know, like turntablism 101. And I was never going to make any money doing that sort of very musically inclined DJing. But I started being like a mobile DJ and I was like, you know, playing kids' birthday parties once every 6 months. And then I was, you know, picking up a whatever here and there, like a school dance and then like a prom and like a wedding. And yeah, by the time I was, you know, 14 years old, it was like every single weekend I had business cards. I had a website. I had, you know, ads in the phone book and in the newspaper. And it was all word of mouth. And I remember these business cards like said, you know, it was DJ Extreme because that was like the coolest word at the time. And it was Brody's Extreme Sound. It was from Brody's DJ Service to Brody's Extreme Sounds. And
that's nice rebranding.
That was a great rebrand for like, you know, yeah, year 2000 or whatever, because it couldn't be any cooler than that. And I remember my business cards that I like printed out at home to start with. It said, I'm just a young teenage DJ who plays your music and mine, because I had this problem where I didn't have all the music I needed. Like CDs were expensive and like I couldn't have, and I kept getting requests for songs that I didn't have. So like that was my polite way of saying like, can I borrow your CDs, you being the client, when I like DJ a job? Like, yeah, no, whatever music you like, here, I'll just take your CDs and play those, you know. And
resourcefulness.
And yeah, so that kind of took off. And so anyway, so fast forward, I almost didn't go to college because that was doing so well. And when I went to Ski Academy, it really had to take the back burner for a second. I would fly home if I got like, you know, a big enough prom to DJ. I would fly home for the weekend from Vermont to DJ a show, but it was no longer every weekend. And I was able to see that there was more to life than just DJing these jobs and just making money. And that's like, you know, junior year, I decided, maybe I should go to college, if anything else, to learn how to be a better business person. So I ended up, you know, I'm like, oh, I want to, and I, you know, I fell in love with skiing during those last 2 years of high school, wanted to move out west, like take the next step that follows New England logically. And I knew that would for me as a park skier, that would be Utah, because, you know, the biggest and best parks were here. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to have to liquidate my business completely to do this. But at that point, like, things meant more to me than just money.
So you always had that like internal, you know, the personal drive to push yourself to progress in these aspects of your life that you might not really know how to do. Like, you saved up to order that VHS to teach yourself how to be a DJ so that you could go and make money being a DJ. Like, you had that ability to hold yourself accountable to your own future and your own success. Like, let's talk about that.
I think I knew pretty early on I didn't want to work for anyone. Like, that was clear when my friends were starting to get jobs at, 16 at Dairy Queen. And I'm like, actually, I'm doing all right playing school dances in Ohio. I'm traveling all over doing this. And I'm getting a name for myself doing this. And I like that little bit of recognition, which is, before social media. And I liked that little bit of, I don't know what the word is. Like, I liked being on stage with my, CD players, like playing music, and people were having a good time because of what I was doing up there, or at least facilitated by what I was doing up there. And getting on the microphone and making sure everyone was having fun and dancing and whatever. And I liked that. And I liked the business aspect. I liked rushing home from, high school senior year to work on contracts and negotiating for equipment. And I had this big trailer full of gear, and, I was able to drive, I drove a trailer my first week with my driver's license. I was driving a 15-foot long trailer too, because it was like, that was part of the gig. And I liked being my own boss. I guess that's kind of it. And not really having someone else tell me what to do. Like I said, my friends were starting to work at Dairy Queen, and I just wanted a different work experience. And that translated when I did go to college. I lost that. I was no longer that person. And I started rock climbing a little bit and working at the climbing gym. But then the next iteration of that kind of was my sophomore year, I ran for student body president, which up until then, all the student body presidents at this little liberal arts private school in Salt Lake, like, they had mostly been kids from Utah. Who knew Utah well, and thus I thought could serve the student body in an easier way. When someone asks the president, hey, where's the best restaurant, or what are we doing this weekend, they're not looking at a map to try to figure out where they are in Salt Lake City, but I decided to run for it, and I won. And so I was running this organization of 80 volunteers when I was a sophomore. Wow. Which is still the kind of time I'm looking up at the older kids. I'm like, oh man, you guys are like the big guys on campus, but I decided to start running this stuff, and then I ran again and I won again. So I ended up doing it through my senior year. And that was just kind of the next iteration. And skiing, I was still skiing most days, but it also kind of took a back burner as this opportunity to, it felt like being an entrepreneur again, because, I was rebranding our student government and I was making it cool and appealing. And at the same time, I was, talking to student body presidents from other colleges and kind of networking with them as far as, I guess you'd call it best practices now, and talking about, the most effective ways and the best concerts they're hosting and, what they're doing for civic engagement and getting students involved in the community and volunteering and all of the things. So it started to tie into much more than just self-serving. DJing was very much about the money and the pride and those kind of things. And this started to be about much more than that. But at the same time, it was still able to tickle the ego a little bit, And then I graduated and I quickly needed a job. And that's when it kind of became, okay, I can still satisfy all those urges, being my own boss, being an entrepreneur, building a business, building a brand, tickle the ego, do it all through hopefully being a professional skier.
Yeah. And now you obviously are a professional skier, but you're so much more than that, right? You're a speaker, you're an activist. And when I think of a well-rounded mountain athlete, mountain person in the outdoor community, I think of you. So when you got started doing all of this, you basically created a career for yourself where there wasn't one before. There wasn't a blueprint. It was a totally new thing. So which of your background or which of your experiences or education helped you build this blueprint, build this roadmap so you could succeed?
Yeah, I got a degree in economics and the philosophy of economics, so to speak. And this college I went to, Westminster, it really taught you how to think. I didn't take all these math classes and I didn't come out with this piece of paper that then you go to your employer and ask for a job or whatever, prospective employer. It was, for me, it was very much about how to think, and it was about a general business education. College was really an end in itself. It wasn't a means to another end for me. I just wanted to learn and I wanted to become a better person. I wanted to be able to offer something to the community and the college community and the greater community. And I was able to do that through there. And then when I graduated, I went through high school and college without any social media. And I'm I'm 30, you know, like I graduated college in 2010, like Facebook and everything was very, very prevalent at the time. It was, I was the minority. I was like the only person who didn't have it, you know? And I just didn't like it. I saw no reason for it, blah, blah, blah. And then I graduated and my first student loan came due 6 months later.
No boy.
And I was like, oh God, I have to pay for this. And I saw this opportunity to take advantage of this social media, which was just growing so quickly. And so I went to these brands. I remember I went to one trade show and I'm like, I took all my savings. I went on like a couple big trips to try to help make a name for myself. And then I had no money left. And I went to one of the outdoor retailer trade shows and the Snow Sports Industry of America trade shows. And I went there and I was like, okay, this is it. I can either walk out of here pretty much a professional athlete, or I can walk out of here and, you know, go get a job at Dairy Queen. And I like had this whole portfolio, this presentation. And the idea wasn't like, hey, I'm Brody Levin, you guys should pay me to be me. It was like, hey, I'm pretty much this no name who's trying to do cool stuff, going on good trips. Why don't you pay me for exactly the value that I offer you? Not based on reputation, but based on like quantifiable information. And this is, I don't know what year this is, 2011 or 12 or something like that, and 13. And I was like, you know, why don't you pay me, for example, I'm going to make a little video from this ski thing that I did or this bike thing that I did. You guys can decide how much it's worth to you and pay me per 1,000 views. Or I just started this social media account. Why don't you pay me for every, you know, pay me $8 for every 100 followers I gain? And like that way they could choose the how they wanted to quantify the content that I was producing, which was like not a thing at the time at all. I was like, I came to all these team managers with this idea and they were like, whoa, this is like, we're used to paying a retainer fee and a photo incentive. And I'm like, well, I'm not really getting shots published in magazines, and a retainer is based off someone's reputation. So like, you're not going to pay me for those reasons, but like, think about it. Like, you're going to have to go to your boss and get approval, but think about it, because I have value I can offer, but you only need to pay me if I offer that to you. And some brands actually bit. They were like, okay, this is like very innovative and very forward thinking. It's going to be hard to get approval because we don't know how much money to budget for you, because we don't know how successful you're going to be. And there were like very practical problems like that. But I went for it as a pragmatic approach as possible. And it started working a little bit. And I walked out of there making money as a skier, not doing anything else. But it was doing something else, because it was this creating content, which was not a thing at the time. And so quickly I was like the most followed skier on social media, which is ridiculous because I wasn't the most famous skier at all. Like, I started getting these interviews about me, but they were just like Brody Levin, the Instagram skier or whatever, man. Because I like latched onto it right away. And, you know, the real famous skiers in the world weren't latching onto it. And now fast forward a few years and the tables have turned. Like, they are the most famous skiers in the world, and thus they are also the most followed skiers in the world now. You know, like the whole ski industry, like I was out ahead of them and they all came and caught up to me, because like it, you know, kind of put things back in where you're supposed to be as far as like your fame and your notoriety. But I was really the first person to latch onto that idea, is like, let me provide something for you besides just a reputation. And you can put a, you know, whatever price tag on that you want.
So that's a super smart strategy. Congrats on that and getting some brands to bite. And now you are a pro skier, but you are also doing some other really interesting stuff. Like, you just got back from DC.
Yeah, I got back yesterday from DC, and that was my second time there this month.
And you were there with American Alpine Club and an Access Fund, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
When did you decide to kind of loop this activism piece into what you're doing in the mountains and get really involved with some of these organizations and be going to DC?
I almost feel like a hypocrite, because I like, you know, so many people in student government get involved because they want to become actual government. You know, like they like student politics because they're practicing for when they run for senator or whatever. And I always was able to like appeal to students because I was like, guys, I'm just trying to make us have the best time in college possible. I don't want to be a politician, you know, and here I am now going to D.C. every few months or a couple times a year. And I'm like, no, I swear I don't want to be a politician. I just happen to be a little involved in politics now. Like I meant it when I said that, you know. And so all these other, you know, student body presidents that I was working with at the time, they're all have gone on to, you know, work in the governor's office or, you know, running for city council or whatever. And I have no political aspirations besides to I have citizen aspirations, not political aspirations. I don't want to work in D.C. I want to go there and be a voice for the outdoor community. And I don't want to run for office. I want to hold the people who do choose to run for office accountable. And so that kind of came pretty quickly just because I was, all right, I was, you know, a professional skier for a couple of years and I was like traveling the world. And after a couple of years of it, I was like, man, this is, even if I'm coming back to share these stories and hopefully inspire people to whatever it is, get outside or challenge themselves or do something good, it wasn't fulfilling enough to me just traveling around skiing. Cause that's ostensibly what I was doing, traveling around on someone else's bill and skiing all over the world and coming back and sharing those stories. And that's like a cop out. That's what like a lot of pro athletes do. You know, they're like, oh, we're going to inspire people. And that's just frequently just a way of saying, I'm going to go do something and hope maybe someone else will care about it. And so I'm like, man, what else can I do? And, you know, and throughout college and actually throughout my life, I was just very environmentally aware. And I was student body president. I was working on a lot of environmental initiatives. And I'm like, okay, now I'm a skier. How can I kind of continue that without having the quote power of student body president? How can I do that with the quote power of professional skier? And it was pretty obvious kind of to me, you know, like through some public speaking, through the organizations I can volunteer with, and through the platform that I've created as a skier, I can start discussing and hopefully making the needle move on the issues that I care about. So in 2013, I climbed and skied Denali with Jeremy Jones, and he found out about like my history and environmental activism, especially throughout college. And he's like, well, like, you know, 3 years ago or 5 years ago, I started this organization called Protect Our Winters. You should think about joining it. And I didn't have, you know, they like having these famous skiers and snowboarders get involved. And I didn't have that fame, but I did have that passion. And thus, I got involved with them. And over the past 5 years, I've become extremely involved with them. And I, you know, I try to be their most active volunteer and do as much as possible with them. And that's kind of eventually translated into other groups like the Sierra Club, American Alpine Club, Winter Wildlands Alliance, Heal Utah, Access Fund, other groups like that I volunteer with.
So all of that is amazing. But you just hit a buzzword for me, and I need to call it back to Denali.
Yeah.
So last June, three of my best friends and I actually went up and we splitboarded Denali.
Oh, right on, man. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Sweet.
So when we were preparing for that trip, I actually found one of your blog posts on Tahoe Mountain Sports that was all about like the essential gear for packing for Denali. And there wasn't a whole lot beyond that. And I found it super helpful. So thank you.
Oh, right on, man. That's, you know, like, wait, it was on Tahoe Mountain Sports, you said?
Yeah, that was the one.
Okay, because I did this. So... Oh, that is, wait, what route did you guys snowboard?
We did the West Buttress.
Right on, dude, congratulations. That is so cool, man. I rode my, it was right after college, before those student loans came due. I rode my bike across the country because I was like so bored and had nothing to do. And I was like living in Montana and my parents were like, hey, are you going to come home for Thanksgiving? And I'm like, yeah, sure. I'm going to like leave tomorrow. And I like got a road bike, which I had never ridden a road bike before. And I just like started pedaling across country.
Naturally.
And every day I was like by myself and I didn't have an iPhone and I was just like bored and I would pedal and it sucked because I wasn't a biker and whatever. And, and it was snowing and raining like every single day on me. And I'm just like pedaling into the headwinds across freaking North Dakota. And, I get this like, or I get home earlier than I thought. And I was going home for Thanksgiving, but I got home on like in early October. And I was like, okay, just like twiddling my thumbs. And I had mailed my laptop home before I left. So I would have it there when I got there. And so I just went on like, you know, whatever.com and started a blog, like brodylevin.com. And I just went back and rewrote verbatim every day's blog entry. So it's like day one, I was writing it, you know, a month after day one, but I was like, day one, you know, today sucks. I don't know how to ride a bike, blah, blah, blah. And so I like wrote about that. And after a couple days of it, I sent it to like everyone I know. You know, I like pulled up my old student body president email list and sent it to all the administrators at my college, which is probably some conflict of interest or something. And I like, I pulled up, you know, I just went through all my contacts again before social media or anything. And I just sent it to everyone. And I started to get like a little following, you know, I got like, oh, 300 people read my blog today. And so after I was done going through rewriting my journal from biking across the country, I'm like, oh gosh, I need to like start writing about other stuff. So I started writing about other trips. And then as I went on trips, I would write about those trips. And I, you know, started writing every single day and tapered off to once a week or a couple times a week. But I had this like big following. And that was, I guess, in essence, my first kind of social media, because people really started to follow that. And when I eventually kind of like just ended it because it was taking too much of my time, it was like, all right, like I have a following now. So how can I transfer that to something good? And that's when I kind of started to use it as social media. But that blog is where I did things was like such as, you know, write about gear for Denali or like write about what it's like to go to South America for 2 months and not speak a word of Spanish or whatever it is. You know, those were the kind of stories I was writing on there. And yeah, it was cool to know people read that stuff. So thanks.
Absolutely, man. Thank you. It definitely helped us prepare for the trip.
Right on.
All right. So this is related to Denali, but I want to say I was actually looking at your website, and on your about page, the like one of the very first lines on there, if not the first line, it says like, "I am Brody Levin. I have never eaten meat."
Yeah.
And I know you grew up vegetarian, so it's not like a big statement about, you know, a diet or a way of life. But so for Denali, it was during a period of my life that I was like trying to be vegan or trying to do vegetarian mostly.
Nice.
And we actually did, myself and my friend Ryan, we did the mountain meatless. And I'm just curious your take on being an adventure athlete who doesn't eat meat and like how you fuel yourself about with it.
Yeah. Well, you guys are in Boston, right?
Yeah, we are.
I don't know if you see this when you come out west, but like, there's this, I've like used to be asked that question and it's pretty much stopped. Like people, it seems at least out west that people have like latched onto the idea and they get it now. They're like, okay, you don't need meat as made clear by this and this, you know, like it is possible to do this without meat. And for me, I've never eaten meat. So I obviously don't need it. Like, I don't know if my body's just adapted to it or what, but you know, if people are like, oh, I feel like this dearth of this lack of whatever if I don't eat it, I'm like, well, I don't know what that feels like because maybe I feel it every day of my entire life.
Yeah.
But I have no idea because I've never had it, right? And so, yeah, maybe I don't have enough of XYZ, but I've never been one to like count calories or grams of protein or anything like that. I just eat. I just eat healthy. I'm not concerned with, like I said, the amount of protein. I don't drink protein shakes. I don't look at any of that stuff. If something's, you know, if I'm gonna make something, I'm just like, oh, like what seems filling or what seems like healthy, you know. I'm just not eating junk food, not eating fast food. And yeah, I mean, I just don't have a good answer. It's just like such a lifestyle for me, you know. Like, I'm going to Asia tomorrow, and like, is it going to be difficult to be vegetarian? Yeah. But is it like an option in my mind? No. You know, I'll just have to figure it out because I just don't eat meat. It's like, I'll look up the couple of dishes and I'll write them down on a piece of paper and I'll like go to a restaurant and I'll like hand them a piece of paper, you know? And like, that's just kind of the only way for, that's the only thing I know. And thus it's easy for me, but I have a lot of respect for people like you who have chosen to do it after eating meat and knowing the way your body responds to it. And also knowing, I'm assuming, how good meat must taste.
So good. Bacon.
Presumably.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a lot harder to give something up than to have never tried it. I would guess.
Totally. I was with another longtime vegetarian, Alex Honnold, this past week in DC. And he was talking about, he's actually working with one of those companies that like makes fake meat products as like one of his sponsors.
Wow.
And he's like, dude, you should like get on that bandwagon. And I like looked at the other athletes and it's like, you know, a bunch of NFL players, NBA players, and Alex Honnold. And I'm like, yeah, I'm like a ski mountaineer that no one's heard of. Like, is that really what I need to, you know, like, is that really possible? But but yeah, and he's kind of saying the same thing, because he came from eating meat, so he's like a little more aware of the ways in which he is a vegetarian. And for me, it's just like pretty just blindly, like I just look at the one thing on the menu that doesn't have meat in it, and it's not like, oh man, everything else sounds so good. It's just like, yeah, that's what I'm gonna have.
That's awesome. So speaking of lifestyle, we wanted to talk a little bit about how you balance everything, because you're always traveling, you have a ton of stuff going on with your activism work and the groups that you work with, your brands that you work with, and we want to understand how you balance that all, how you make sure your relationships aren't suffering, that your, you know, mental mindfulness is not suffering. How do you do that?
Maybe I don't. Maybe I don't. Like, I'm trying to think of the things I have to sacrifice in my life, which are a lot, right? I mean, for example, I sacrifice some ski ability because I do more than just ski. I'm sure I could be a better skier if I went every day and if that's all I cared about. But I care about so much more than that. Why am I not going every day? Because maybe I'm, you know, getting my suit fitted to go to DC, or maybe I decided to just go for a run that day.
Right.
And I could be a better ice climber, but you know, some days I would just rather go rock climbing, or I would rather go for a trail run in the snow. And so like, and that is just a selfish thing. That is just to keep me interested, to keep me, I think, fit in a more well-rounded way. It's kind of like the jack of all trades, master of none. Like if I'm just kind of always training, and it's not, I don't think of it as training. It's just like, hey, what do I want to do today? Well, it's cloudy, so the skiing up high might be bad, and running when it's cloudy, you know, that might be a nice temperature, but it might be kind of uninspiring. So maybe I just go climb in the gym today. But it's like, I'm not one of those people who have to move every day, like by nature. I like to say my equilibrium is kind of on a couch with like ice cream on my lap.
That's mine too.
Yeah. See, like that's totally, I think that's a pretty normal thing.
Yes, absolutely.
I don't need to move every day, but I force myself to, just like a lot of people that, you know, you see at 24-hour fitness at 6 a.m. nobody necessarily wants to be doing that. Or I think a lot of people don't, but, I know it's important for me to move my body every day. It's easy for me to sit and get stuck on emails all day, but I'll, you know, try to get out for a bike ride or whatever. So I do sacrifice a lot, and the balance comes more emotionally for me, because I know by having that balance of I did my emails for half the day, I'll get a couple hours of exercise, and then I'll, you know, spend some time with my girlfriend. Like that is what I think my thought of balance is, but in reality is something else being compromised, like for sure. Whether that's, you know, I don't know, like something always is, you know, we're always compromising. I don't think I'm alone in this at all. Like we always have to try to strike that balance, and something is probably going to fall by the wayside. But I try to stay on top of it. And maybe the biggest thing for me is that I while equilibrium for me is on the couch, I don't do it. I like never sit on the couch, and I'm like very proactive and I think self-motivated, insofar as like, you know, if there's something at the bottom of the stairs that needs to go up, I will just take it instantly instead of being like, oh, I'll take it next time I need to go upstairs. Or my inbox is always at zero, and you know, my car is always clean and the house is always organized, because if I get behind on one of those things, I feel like that's where stuff starts to snowball. And this is just by nature of this is who I am, right? Like I'm pretty OCD, but yeah, I think it allows me to then when I go in the mountains and my life is on the line, or my partner's life is on the line, or I need to be belaying someone or whatever it is, I can be fully present without thinking about like, oh man, I should have responded to those emails. And I think by virtue of doing activities in the mountains that have death as the highest consequence, I think it both demands and it's pretty natural to be totally present in those situations. And that's what's nice, because it allows me to escape a little bit and not just be thinking about, you know, day-to-day life. And it's what makes me feel alive. And I think that's really, really important in today's world, especially.
Yeah, dude, I relate in so many of the same ways. And I think a lot of our listeners probably do as well. And that is a struggle for a lot of people who think they have to find some sort of singular focus on one thing to be successful, and sacrifice balance in other aspects. And
yeah, and I mean, if I were to try to succeed just as a skier, which I mean, I do, like I make my living from sponsors. But if I was to try to succeed just by saying I'm the best skier in the world, it wouldn't happen because I cannot have that singular focus, which is necessitated to be the best in the world. I mean, that is an absolute requirement, I think, to have that, you know, whatever the 10,000 hour thing or whatever it is. Like, I don't have that drive in me to do it that way. I would much rather, like, I'm just like an adventure. I mean, like, in reality, like, I think one reason I call myself a professional skier is slightly out of like that ego thing. In reality, it's just like, I'm a professional like adventurer. I can like choose my sponsors. If I just stop skiing tomorrow and I chose to like, oh, I'm going to go bike packing around the world, or I'm going to go try to climb this route that's never been climbed before, they'll be like right there with me because I'm working with brands in a capacity that they understand that I'm appealing to people that do more than just one thing, that care about more than just skiing. They care about like being a well-rounded person. And that's what I care about as well.
Yeah. So speaking of adventures, we understand that you're going on a trip. Is it tomorrow that you're flying out?
That's correct. Yeah.
Awesome. So we've been following your preparations in your gear room. Looks really awesome. You're like throwing things around on the floor. do you want to tell us a little bit about what you have coming up and where you're going to go do?
Yeah. So I will, last year or so, I've been planning this trip. Actually, for the last couple of years, I was trying to go to this country of Georgia, which borders Russia, kind of in like the Eurasia continent. And I was trying to find the right line to ski there. And I knew there was really steep mountains and really big mountains and great ski mountaineering potential, but I just couldn't find what I wanted to do there. And when you're going like, you know, halfway around the world, you can't just be like, oh, I'll just find something to ski when I'm there. I mean, you can. I've done that before. But like, that's not what I'm looking for. I'm looking for like big, steep, technical lines that also have some story behind them and some kind of element of interest besides just people who want to go steep skiing.
For sure.
And so I, you know, was sitting on Google Earth and researching the country and like found this line that hasn't been totally skied, and it's on a huge mountain. It's on the border of Russia. Like, the summit of the mountain is the border of Russia. Wow. Or with Russia. And yeah, I like did the whole pitching for funding and did the whole blah, 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 and like, and making it happen. And I've been looking forward to this trip for a really long time. And now, you know, I'm loading up whatever it is, 5 duffel bags with gear, and flying half around the world for a month to try to climb and ski one line.
Well, that's absolutely epic, and I'm super jealous over here. But that's so cool that's like, you know, where you've built this up to.
I mean, this is what I guess over the years, like it's kind of turned into this for me. You know, it's been like a series of small trips. You know, I haven't been home for a month, and now I'm just gonna, you know, I got home from DC yesterday, and tomorrow I'm leaving for a month. And
wow.
I do like this. It's like not getting old insofar as I'm enjoying the traveling still, but I'm trying to be more purposeful with it. I'm trying to make sure I'm doing good storytelling, either about the environment or about public lands or about avalanche education while I'm doing it. And I'm trying to, you know, I put a lot of time into the PR of it, so to speak, making sure it's getting in front of the right eyes of people that I think will actually take something positive away from it.
Well, that's amazing. We will absolutely be following along and cheering you on, hoping that all does go to plan. But as things do on these adventures, you know, you never know what happens. You know, you might not succeed or you might absolutely crush it.
Thanks so much, man. Yeah, you understand like the likelihood of it actually happening. Except, did you get to Denali the first time you tried?
No, we didn't. Actually, the first time we bought our climbing permits for Denali, it was back in 2013. So I would have seen you on the mountain.
Okay, nice.
But actually, Ethan and Ryan and I, the buddies that I went on this trip with, we went down to South America and we started by climbing Aconcagua.
Nice.
And then after that, we traveled for 4.5 months, went up the Pan American Highway and volunteered for a week in every country we passed and went on this just, you know, big vagabond adventure and documented the whole thing. But we ran out of money in Guatemala. We never made it.
Dude, I want to interview you, man. What an experience. That is so cool. Good for you.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a ton of fun. And we ended up getting to Denali last summer.
Oh, man, that's incredible. Yeah, well, that's awesome.
Yeah, it was amazing. But I'm certainly well-versed in the adventures not going as planned. But I hope yours do. I really hope that this adventure in Georgia is successful for you and you hit the line you want. Now, anybody who wants to follow Brody on this adventure and all of his future adventures, it's worth checking his stuff out at BrodyLevin.com and at BrodyLevin across all social media. Is that right?
That's right.
Well, thanks so much for chatting with us today, Brody. It's been super inspiring hearing all of your stories.
Yeah, thanks for the interview, Jonathan and Emily. You guys have a good one.
Well, that was adventure skier and storyteller Brody Levin. Again, you can catch him across social media at Brody Levin and BrodyLevin.com. Really inspiring guy.
Yeah, love that conversation. To make sure that you don't miss any interviews coming up on the Stokecast, make sure you subscribe today. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Emily Holland.
And I'm Jonathan Ronzio. We'll catch you next week with another episode of the Stokecast.